Rod Hugelman from the Mahomet Ecclesia in Mahomet, Illinois, or also known as Champaign area. And Brother Rod is going to be speaking on us on a topic that I'm sure we have all found in reading the volumes. It's one of the chapter headings, so pay very close attention. The title of Brother Rod's discourse is Nature's Separate and Extinct. Somehow I don't think that was quite the way that read, but that's all right. It is Nature's Separate and Extinct. So we'll turn it over to Brother Rod.
Thank you, Brother Craig. We want to especially bring you the love of the brethren in Mahomet, and especially Brother Jim and Sister Linda McClugan, who wanted to be here and were planning to be here, but because of illness at the last moment, we got a call from them the other evening and they weren't able to come. So they especially wanted to be here. Also, Brother and Sister Williams, they especially wanted to be remembered too. Thank you. Now our subject is Nature Separate and Extinct. And because we really have, it's not the chapter title in the first volume. It has to do instead with the warfare with which we are always constantly plagued. We have earthly mindedness and we have spiritual mindedness. And these are two natures at war against one another. And they are totally separate, and we have to really consider which one is going to be extinct. So it's a very serious study, and one that plagues us continually. For example, if we have the human mindedness here, once we enter into the Holy of the Tabernacle and begin our program along this narrow way, we have these two conditions, human mindedness and spiritual mindedness. If we allow the one to grow at the expense of the other, ultimately this one will be extinguished in any case. But if it grows at the expense of this one, it too is extinguished. And then we're extinguished. See the problem? We become extinct. On the other hand, if we allow this one to become extinguished as the spiritual mind grows, then we'll find ourselves ultimately on the divine plane and in the presence of the Father of Lights. Now that's quite a difference, isn't it? Now along this narrow way, what we're trying to do is follow in the footsteps of Jesus. And so to do that, we've got to understand with whom we are warring this terrible struggle. We have a serious warfare. We have the world, the flesh, and the devil, the adversary. And unfortunately, one of our principal partners in this exercise, now just imagine this business partner that you have, he doesn't think like you do. Everything you want to do, he doesn't want to do. He's totally opposed to you. When he gets hungry, he says, feed me. He doesn't care what you have in mind. That takes precedent. When you want to continue studying, he says, no, I'm tired, I'm going to bed, and I want you to stop too. That's the human nature, isn't it? It's sitting. We're stuck with this partner. And this partner's always offering us advice. Invariably wrong, of course. So, no, you're too extreme on this. No, I don't want you to do that. Don't you think we should go to the ball game? I want to watch this TV program. It has all sorts of things it wants to do. And we have to tell them, now look, I'm a senior partner in this affair. I am the senior partner. Don't forget that. That's the new creature talking. So have this constant struggle, the one with the other. And so what we're going to do is we're going to try and know our enemy. Could you imagine a soldier which would show up for the battle and say to the commander, I'm all ready to go. Who's the enemy? They say, you mean you don't know? Well, you've got to study your enemy or you can't possibly succeed. This is another tragedy, is that our partner along this way is actually also our enemy. And this is something to realize. The flesh is an enemy. We have to be careful of that. The manna text told us about the regulation of one's conscience. We have little vestige of the conscience once provided in Adam. Very little of that left. And consequently, what little is left must be carefully nourished, nurtured, and very, very carefully regulated. We can't really trust what vestige we have left. Our major goal then is to see the new nature born in Zion on that golden plain and with God likeness. That's really going to be a beautiful and marvelous program. Now for Jesus, now he was perfect, just a little lower than the angels at the time he stepped down from that grand estate next to the Father, took upon himself the nature of men. Even for him, this was a great step downward, and the flesh was not even up to the task that he had before him. The proof of that was that in exercising the Father's will, it ended up destroying that flesh, didn't it? It consumed it, used it up. Now, it only took 3.5 years. Now, compare his situation with ours. We have very little to work with. And it's extremely contrary. Not easy to keep under condition. Jesus' flesh was perfect, and he had the perfect mind to control it. Our mind is not perfect. Our flesh is far more deteriorated, and the Lord, praise be to him, considers just our will, the fact that we want to do better, as though we have done better. Aren't you glad of that? How'd you like to be measured according to your actual successes? Ever made a list of those? Precious short, isn't it? Ever made a list of your failures? Too long to list. Very discouraging. And yet, we have this confidence that we have a standing in the Beloved, in Jesus. So he's made that arrangement. But the flesh will encroach constantly upon us, and so we have to know our enemy, and that's what we're going to consider. Now, after this 6,000 years of deterioration, we find that the human mind as a whole, in spite of its remarkable character, is so deteriorated, so distorted and warped, that at the very best, it's hardly capable of reason at all, and we should be considered feeble-minded. At its worst, we're quite insane. Now, if you don't think so, let's just pick a couple of examples which are common in the world today, just to give you an illustration of the difference between what is now human-mindedness and spiritual-mindedness. If you wanted to be the best in all the world, how would you do that? How would the world reckon that? Well, let's see. You'd get a little canvas floor area about from here to the wall square, and you'd get into that little room there and you put some things on your hands, and then for 3 minutes, for 15 rounds, you'd beat senseless anybody who got into that ring with you. And if you could do that so that nobody could survive except you, you'd be declared the champion of the world and you'd be famous. See, that's the way the world looks at it. Or if you want to be a hero in the world's eyes and very famous and rich, you have to be able to take this little leather bladder, little oblong thing, and you take that at one end of a field about 100 yards long, and if you can run from one end of the field to the other end while 11 other people try to knock you down and beat you into senselessness, why, then you're considered another hero and you get a big contract and you're rich and famous. Now, those are the things the world genuinely considers to be really great. That's greatness in the eyes of the world. And those are sports. We have politics as well. Anyone who has a very charismatic aura is a person who's going to get himself elected president or can be promoted like some sort of commodity. Genuine, true qualities are seldom used and seldom successful. So we see there is a really an enormous contrast between what the world will see and what we see. And we have another thing to keep in mind here too. We must be aware of the fact that we are the results, all of us, the product of 6,000 years of careful development. During the past 6,000 years, the development of this earth has been such that those who are the most vicious, the most grasping, the most proud, the meanest, the toughest, those are the ones who succeed, you see. Those are the ones who lived. What happened to the meek, the mild? Well, they were all killed, of course. And so, down over the years, we've carefully culled out the best in humankind and promoted the worst. And all of us are the product of that development. Let's not forget that. And so the spirit of combativeness, the desire to succeed and rise to the top, all these are characteristics which we have in us, you see, and things which are related to the old man. So when the old man offers advice, you be sure and ask from which quarter it comes. We'll look at some more examples later. Now we have some scriptures here we'd like to point out to you first before we get into the principal subject, just to show how this works. Let's take a look at Galatians 5. And here we have Galatians 5, 14 through 17. For all the law is fulfilled in one word, even in this, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. That's such a simple thing, but you see, that's contrary to all of the way in which the world works. Love thy neighbor. Remember what Will Rogers and some others once said? It says, the golden rule, the way mankind interprets it, is do unto others as they'd like to do unto you, but do it to them first. That's the way they see it. That's the way the world actually works. But if ye bite and devour one another, take heed that ye be not consumed one of another. See, this is God's wisdom. This I say then, walk in the Spirit. See, we're going to exalt this spiritual portion. And ye shall not fulfill the lust or desires of the flesh. For the flesh lusteth against the Spirit against the flesh. These are contrary the one to the other, so that ye cannot do the things that ye would. And so we've got to learn to overcome that. Very difficult. And so we want to understand ourselves, know thyself. We want to understand ourselves so we can better cope with the problems which beset us. Combativeness. One could argue, well, aren't we supposed to be combative? I mean, we've got to succeed in this narrow way. We want to have a competitive spirit. No, that's not the idea. Well, what about the Apostle Paul's thoughts there in 1 Corinthians 9:24, where he says about how those who run the race, don't they all run all, only one receives the prize? Friends, we're not talking here about a 100-yard dash where you sit there and try to eke out a victory over another by inches. We're not running for the prize of the high calling with others running for the same prize in the desperate hope that somehow we'll inch out over them and get the crown and they'll be left holding the bag. It's not the idea at all. The idea is if you finish the race, you'll get the crown. And he's talking to the Corinthians, the Greeks, and they had in mind a very special race, the marathon. We forget sometimes that the Marathon is called that in honor of the place, Marathon. And it was quite a different story entirely. There, they had a great battle against tremendous odds. They had no chance of victory, it seemed. But when victory was secured at Marathon, they sent a runner back to the king. Now, this runner had to run through all of these obstacles, just as we do in our race, to the king. And when he got there, it was some 26 miles, I believe, a little over 26 miles. He was so exhausted that he came up to the king and he uttered only one word: victory. And then he died. That's the race that's before us. And that's the kind of competitiveness we should have. The race is against ourself, not our brethren. Now, we sometimes think, as we look at the age in which we live and the accelerating time of increase of knowledge, that surely this must be, as Brother Russell had suggested in one place, the brain age, an age of intelligence, an age of reason. To a certain extent, that's true. It's an age which is becoming an age of reason, but alas, far too slowly. It's the space age, all right, and there has been a tremendous jump in knowledge, but knowledge is not the same as wisdom. Knowledge, the old man can assimilate. Wisdom belongs to the new. In the past 100 years, we've seen this tremendous increase in knowledge. What has been the result of it? As Daniel tells us in Daniel 12, as the Lord told us in Matthew 24, it has meant a time of trouble such as was not since there was a nation. Why should knowledge be of such a character? Shouldn't knowledge bring with it peace and blessings? Indeed, it should. But only when that knowledge produces wisdom. So there's a great difference between knowledge and wisdom. What goodness has come from this increase of knowledge in the last 100 years has come not because of man, you can be sure of that. Indeed, even the knowledge itself is there because of the presence of the King. We're the same people we were 200 years ago. Indeed, exams show that the average intellect of the average person is actually going down. The IQ test levels show a lower score every year. We're actually deteriorating. It strikes at the heart of the evolutionist, of course, but then we don't care about him. We are deteriorating little by little. So we were actually smarter then than we are now. But the presence of the King has brought with it this great increase of knowledge. The light has arrived to dispel the noxious vapors of the darkness of prejudice and gloom. And that's what we see before us. And the prospect really is transporting. Proverbs 4 gives us an insight into the difference between knowledge and wisdom. And this is directed to us, you can be sure of that. Hear, ye children, the instruction of a father, and attend to no understanding. You'll notice that knowledge is not mentioned here. For I give you good doctrine, forsake ye not my law. For I was my father's son, tender and only beloved in the sight of my mother. He taught me also and said unto me, let thine heart retain my words, keep my commandments and live. Get wisdom, get understanding, forget it not, neither decline from the words of my mouth. Forsake her not, and she shall preserve thee. Love her, and she shall keep thee. Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom, and with all thy getting, get understanding. We don't want to just know the facts. We want to understand. We don't want to know just what Brother Russell said. We want to know why he said it. When we know why he said it, then we'll understand. We don't want to know what the Bible says. The whole world knows what the Bible says. All they have to do is know how to read. We want to understand what it says. That's the difference between the world and the Lord's people. We have to have that spiritual understanding. The increase of knowledge and understanding, isn't that just what the world wants now that the king has returned and is active? Well, we could say that the answer to that might be yes, to the downtrodden and those who are used and abused. But of course, the answer is no to those who will have to give up that which they had and transfer it to others. So, we see then why it is a time of great trouble. Trouble for those who used to be those who oppressed the world of mankind. When the Lord returned, and we took a look finally at what happened in 1914 when those kings were deposed and the governments placed in the hands of the people. That was a terrible time if you were a king. You see, there's not much employment for used kings anymore. But if you were the people, what a difference. Why, the joy. It's a wonderful thing. So in many cases, whether it's a time of trouble or not is in the eye of the beholder. To the world who sees the incoming kingdom, just as it mentions in Joel, it is the Garden of Eden before them, and behind them a burning wasteland. They want that kingdom so bad anything gets in its way, they'll burn it up. That's what we see. They want that kingdom, and they're going to have it. Now, those in power and in the old world, what do they say? They say, we'll fight to the death. And the Lord says, well, that's all right with me. That's the way you want it. Because nothing's going to stand in His way. He'll have that program. If they stand in the way, they'll be run over. If they get with the program, they'll be blessed by that program. Our King truly knows no defeat. Now, there are some characteristics of the human mind that we need to keep in mind. Well, there you go. We have some characteristics of the human mind. We're going to look at those, and perhaps that'll help us both in our studies and our attitudes towards one another and towards ourselves, too. One of the major things we have to understand is that the mind has tremendous inertia. And sometimes it's almost the immovable object. We have to understand, of course, that we should stand for the truth and be set for its defense, but we have to make sure that we're not so immovable that we find that our mind is set in cement. Now, we have to have our arguments then based on wisdom and the power of the truth, and not just upon the fact that it's too difficult to change your mind. That's hard to do. And that accounts for why there's so few of us here, one of the reasons why there's so few of us here and so many out there. They were in a church, their friends were there, they had their beliefs and their viewpoints. Someone came along and suggested, well, now here is something superior. Some of us took a look at that divine plan and said, that's a wonderful thing. Ready to throw out what we had and accept that. Others said, too much trouble. Didn't want to unlearn. Unlearning's very hard. Learning's hard. Unlearning's harder yet. And if you have to unlearn and then learn, oh my, might as well forget that. Very difficult process. The mind is very painfully programmed. It is the most colossally complex computer system known. There is nothing in the form of electronic computers anywhere which even begins to approach the complexity of the human mind. Many of the viewpoints which the mind develops over the years are developed at great cost and expense, mentally speaking, and are assimilated over a long period of time. Enormous amounts of information are packed in there. Now somebody comes along and says, the work of a lifetime must be discarded. You say, oh my goodness, I don't think I could do that. Replace it with what? Well, it's bound to be just as difficult. Oh, this will take another lifetime. You're asking a lot. That's why it's very difficult in our witnessing efforts and talking to someone highly entrenched in one of the nominal systems to get any kind of movement about them. We must appreciate their mental thinking. We must appreciate that for them there is tremendous inertia involved here. We're asking a lot of them to ask them to abandon what they believe and how that works. To change your mind or reprogram that by dumping what is a lifetime of accumulated information is so difficult, you'll seldom find anyone willing to do that. Now, in science, it's said that progress is often measured by the death rate of the old-timers. That's almost true. Because, you see, they too have the same problem. Even though they're scientists supposed to be involved with the facts, knowledge, and its advancement, they have the same problem. Mental inertia. The difficulty of learning. They'll often defend an error. Why? Well, because they understand that. They at least have arguments for why they believe the error, even if they aren't very good. And it's so much easier to defend what's wrong with the arguments you already have than to pursue the truth, which they're entirely too tired to have to learn. And so we saw the strange circumstance where Albert Einstein came out with a whole new theory, relativity. It was almost a decade before there was anyone more than a handful in the whole world who could understand what he was talking about. It took that long for the old timers to die off, the young people to come up who were willing to examine it. Now, of course, every college student who takes any sort of advanced physics has to learn how to derive from scratch the very things which Albert Einstein developed himself. Really, it isn't difficult at all. It's very simple. Everything's easy once you know how. Everything's easy once you know how. We find the divine plan is simple, don't we? But try explaining it to someone else. But people usually don't want to wait to find out how. So that becomes an extremely difficult thing for them. But this is the way the human mind works. We have to resist that. So when we're preparing our studies and we want to study up on a subject and we get out those reprints and our Bible and the volumes and all the study helps we can get a hold of and those concordances, what's the first thing that comes to mind? It's the old man, your partner, sitting over there. He looks at all this standing around you and says, oh my gosh, am I tired. Do I have to go through all that? That's the natural reaction. And you just have to smile and kindly say, yep, you have to go through all that. I'm sorry, but that's the way it is. And just press ahead. So if you have those feelings and reactions from time to time, you mustn't feel bad about it. That's what I'm trying to tell you, is that these are natural things. Natural-mindedness, human-mindedness. It's the traits of the mind. If you ever read something and after reading two or three paragraphs, or maybe two or three pages in one of your studies, you stop and you can't even remember if you read it or not. You wonder, which page am I on? You go back and you say, you have to go back till you find out where you started reading last that you remember reading it. Mental fatigue, you see. The brain will actually turn itself off. After a time, it's just too much work. It says, I'm tired, I won't do it anymore. And you say, that's what you think. You go back there and you start over again and you keep driving it and driving it until it understands who's the boss. You're going to run the program not the flesh, see? You'll find out if you do that enough times, pretty soon you'll train it, and your mind will be able to study as long as you want. It won't become fatigued like it used to before. That's just a physical thing that you can train your mind to do. Another aspect of human-mindedness is a common thing, just to show you how it works again, prejudice. Prejudice means to prejudge, judge before you get the facts. Now, we have examples of that in our own time, especially prominent in this country. We see the racial problem which occurred in this country. Now, just imagine how ridiculous this is, that a man's character and worth could be judged by the pigmentation in the outer epidermis of his skin. That's just so laughable that you'd hardly consider that serious, except that the whole country worked that way. And as a matter of fact, just a little over 100 years ago, the Supreme Court of the United States decided that such individuals were not subject to the laws of this country and its freedoms. Why? Because they said they're considered property and not human beings. That was the Supreme Court of the United States decided that. That's what prejudice does. It's to judge before the facts. That's human-mindedness. And you'll notice that their reason, we just have to put quotes around that, that was an excuse, wasn't it? That was the reasoning of an unsound, unstable, insane mind. And yet, they were the preeminent judges of this nation. Now, the attorney who was involved in that, attorney from Illinois, I believe Lincoln was his name, said that if I ever get a chance, I'm going to change that. He got a chance, and he changed it. Now, 100 years later, what happens? Supreme Court of the United States completely turned around. Reason has begun to set in. Why? Because mankind's smarter? No. More compassionate? No. Because the king had returned. The king had returned, and it was not possible for these things to exist as they did before. Human-mindedness. It's a terrible thing, and we must be on guard against it at all times. Now we have some instruction for us in Romans 12. We're going to take a look at Romans 12 for the rest of our period here, because we want to see just in this one chapter alone the contrast between the way the Lord expects us to look at things and to do things and the way the human mind would just naturally do it. And we see how different that will be and how we have to fight against it. Okay, Romans 12, 1-3, we're very familiar with. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. Now, right there, all you have to do is look around at the few in this room and the many outside this room, and you'll see just how unreasonable that service is in the minds of the world. And in fact, it was unreasonable in your mind also, your human mind, that is. You doubtless weighed this matter, at least for a time, and doubtless the thought came into your mind, this, you don't want to do all, think of all the terrible things God is going to ask you to give up. You won't be able to do this, that, the other, and all these things. Your mind imagined all sorts of things that you wouldn't be able to do, which you probably never did anyway, but you just made a big long list of all these terrible demands. And the Lord sat back in silence and said nothing. He says, if you can overcome all that and still consecrate, in spite of all of the imaginings of your mind, probably put there by the adversary for sure, I know you'll be all right. We consecrate anyway, and we say, well, I know the Lord's going to do all this. I'm going to have to give up all these things. It's going to be a terrible, terrible program, but I'll do it. So we enter in because of our love for Him. We're willing to step over all of these things which are against the flesh. And when we do, we step into that golden room, and God says, now I'm going to tell you what it's really like. And so we find out He asks us to give up nothing that we wouldn't want to give up ourselves. And in return for having to give up nothing that we wouldn't want to give up anyway, He gives us fellowship such as we've never seen before. We've lost our best friends perhaps before. How many did we have? Oh, goodness, we might have had two or three even. How many friends do we have now? Deeper friends, truer friends than ever before. What price have we paid? It's nothing, is it? What have we received in exchange? Everything. Price of gold being what it is today, if you had all of it in the world, could you buy what is promised to you? Couldn't. It's impossible. And so, you see, the narrow way is precious indeed. So when the Apostle Paul says this is a reasonable service, you better believe it's a reasonable service. Nobody ever got paid as we have been and will be paid. Be not conformed to this world. Be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that ye may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. For I say, through the grace given unto me, to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly, according as God hath dealt to every man the measure of faith. That's a powerful, powerful verse. Notice how the Spirit sees things as opposed to the way the world would see that. If the Apostle Paul had been in the world, he would say, I say through the authority given me. He'd stand up tall, big robes, probably a little gold crown on his head. Instead, there he was, a man who was a tent maker, to pay his own way so that he'd be holding to no man. Through the grace given unto me, what a privilege. What a great, it was just a gift to him, this privilege. To every man that is among you, don't think too highly of yourself. If you think too highly of yourself, you might not take this step. So he says, don't think too highly, but think soberly, accordingly as God hath dealt to every man the measure of faith. He then goes on to point out to us how we are many members in one body, all members, even though we don't have the same office. And time being what it is, we'll just refer you to 1 Corinthians 2, 9 through 16 as for your home study. But we want to notice here that Christ is not one but many members. And each of these members is very important. Now this is an important concept here. When we begin to realize that God looks on the inner man and not the outer man, it should help us to have greater appreciation of one another as brethren, as the Lord's people. The Creator of the universe has tapped you on the shoulder and has asked you if you would like to be His son. Now remember that the next time you're talking to your brethren, that they're one of those people too. They're pretty important people. And so if we understand that, we will be very careful about our conduct towards them, how we talk about them, and how we deal with them. And we'll deal with them as true partners in the narrow way. He points out, too, that too often we look at the other members of the body, the important members of the body. And he contrasts the fact that what we consider important members of the body, we decorate up and make look nice, and ignore some other small parts of the body, he says, which are probably the more vital. Just as an example, we learned last night about how the bullock and Lord's goat were burned both without the camp, in the court, and is also pictured on the third fire in the holy. Now, what was burned without the camp was the hide, specifically mentioned. Why? Because that's the outside part. That's what the world sees. They just see the outside. They don't see the fat, all of the other things which we're privileged to see. And think about human-mindedness again. What does the human mind do? Well, of course, I don't do it as much as some, but some spend a lot of time fixing their hair up, see? And they do that to improve their appearance. Does your appearance improve your health? Think about those things, you see. What does it actually do for you? What have you done lately for your liver? What have you done lately for your heart? Is that not far more vital than your hair? Your hair is never going to do you any good. Mine's falling out and I'm doing just fine. Never had any fun with it anyway. So it illustrates that we spend entirely too much effort on cosmetic surface appearance rather than things that really count. And that's what the Apostle Paul mentions. Now that's true of the body also. The body of Christ, that is. Who do you suppose will have those principal positions in the kingdom on the other side, the veil? How many elders do you suppose will be in those positions of authority? I think not only precious few, there'll be precious few elders there, I'm sorry to say. Probably because, as the Apostle Paul again also said, be not many of you teachers, because you'll receive the greater temptations. Now that suggests that there is the greater probability of failure. There'll be some little sister in a corner somewhere, which everyone's overlooked, paid no attention to much, who's likely to have a very important position up there. That position is based upon fidelity and faithfulness and character. It's not based upon prominence, the ability to speak, or any of those things. Those are merely extra privileges which elders, speakers have, to try and encourage their brethren. But all of us have the privilege of encouraging one another in our private conversation. So we should take advantage of that. So remember that we should place proper emphasis where it belongs. Don't be confused by worldly mindedness, human mindedness, and look at the prominent things, the outward things. Notice again in contrast here, he mentions in verse 8, or he that exhorteth, or exhortation, he that giveth, let him do it with simplicity. What a contrast that is. Notice the goal here. The Lord's people should present a message with such simplicity that you can understand it. How does the world do it? You ever watched a professor up there trying to puff himself up? He uses the biggest $3 words he can find so that everybody will think he's smart. He doesn't care whether you learn anything or not. He just wants to appear brilliant, important. That's human-mindedness. Quite a contrast here. We see that all the time. He that rules, rules with diligence. Here we have a king who's going to rule with diligence as an illustration. If you show mercy with cheerfulness instead of bitterness, begrudgingly, so on. If you do that, it's not accomplished. The ability to render mercy to another should be done with cheerfulness. It's a privilege and honor. Let love be without dissimulation. Abhor that which is evil. Cleave to that which is good. These are just the opposite things. The world's just backwards. I once had an opportunity for a job as an executive in a company. As part of that, they give you a psychological exam, sort of the inkblot test, like Brother was mentioning the other day. Well, they have a whole series of questions that they ask you. And, of course, one of the toppers is they want to know, what do you really want from this world? Now, I knew what they expected you to say. I want to be president of this company, and then after that I want to be chairman of the board. And they say, boy, there's an aggressive person. He's going to do fine. That's the person we want. You can imagine how long I lasted when I told them, I just want to be left alone. But see, I had to tell him the truth. Isn't that really what we want from this world? We just want to be left alone. To us, you see, real comfort and joy is to be with our brethren, separate from the world, alone, able to study the truth in quietness. You can't imagine anything better than that now, can you? But to the world, they say, oh my goodness, man's hopeless. Never will get anywhere. Well, they're probably right. I won't get anywhere in this world, but I don't want to get anywhere in this world. See? Our goal is Christ and Christ alone. Be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love, in honor preferring one another. See, once we see the inner man, that the king's daughter is all glorious within, we'll look for those traits in our brethren. You'll see them. You look hard enough, you'll see the reflection of the face of the Lord. Because it's there. And you have to strive to see that. Not slothful in business, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. Rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation. All these characteristics totally contrary to the world and its condition. Bless them which persecute you. Bless and curse not. My, there's one for you. That's almost impossible to imagine in the minds of the world. They hit you. If somebody hits them, they want to hit them twice. The Iranians kill 49 American hostages. We intend to vaporize the entire nation. That's justice for you, you see. But instead, the Lord's way is, after they kill the 49 hostages, we'd say, what can we do for you? Isn't that what we're going to do? Isn't that what Jesus did? He's dying on the cross for those who put him up there. Next time somebody gives you a hard way to go in the world, whether it's at work or at home or in the street, and your patience is just such and you're just beside yourself, see, that's the old man, your partner is causing you trouble again. You have to stop and say, now just hold on here. That's the person I'm sacrificing and dying for, that I intend to bring up this highway of holiness. He's only blind, after all, and doesn't really see. And so, once we have understanding and use the spiritual mind rather than the earthly mind, it does help us to better appreciate our condition, the condition of others, and to be far, far more charitable. Be of the same mind one toward another. Mind not high things. Condescend to men of low estates. Be not wise in your own conceits. Recompense no man evil for evil. Provide things honest in the sight of all men. All these are such noble things to the spiritual mind. But you'll be dragging the human mind, kicking and screaming along every step of the way. And we must keep doing that until it is finally humbled enough that we can enter into that kingdom. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. And the whole portion of that chapter, the rest of it, is especially important. I'm sorry our time's up. But we can see how important it is to see the mind of Christ and not the earthly mind. Human-mindedness is something that must be overcome if we are to enter into that glory. We must never allow ourselves the luxury of saying, well, that's just the way I am. That's the human mind. That's just the way he is. We must instead look upon the face of the Lord and say, that's the way I want to be. And so let that ever be our goal, that you might make your calling and election sure. That's my prayer on your behalf, dear brethren. And I ask an interest in your prayers on my behalf to the same end. May the Lord bless you all.
Thank you, Brother Rod. And we'll ask Brother Rod to dismiss us and also ask a blessing on the...
Our kind and most merciful Heavenly Father, we're so thankful for the privilege of being able to call Thee our Father. We want to be made ever aware of the importance of that, all that it means to us and to Thy people everywhere. And so we ask a blessing upon Thy people everywhere and upon ourselves, that we might walk circumspectly in this narrow way. We ask too Thy blessing upon this ecclesia who's endeavoring to serve these Thy people. We ask Thy blessing upon the temporal provisions provided, that even through that our fellowship might abound, and that we might also gain the temporal strength to be of greater service to Thee. We ask all these things and humbly give Thee our thanks and ask for Thy forgiveness for our shortcomings. In Jesus' precious name. Amen.